Welcome to the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society. Welcome to ITSP Magazine. You're listening to a new Impactful Innovations podcast with JJ Snow. You're about to join JJ for another insightful, uplifting discussion with innovators who seek to make the world a better place and are led by their hearts to take on some of the toughest challenges facing humanity. Knowledge is power, now more than ever.
Welcome to Impactful Innovations, the podcast that's all about inspiring innovations and uplifting conversations. I'm your quantumly interconnected tech host, JJ Snow, and I'm simply delighted to introduce today's positively passionate tech guest. Joining us today is Dexter Ang, the CEO and co-founder of Pison, a biopotential situational awareness and robotics human-machine interface platform that allows anyone to control anything, anywhere, with the blink of an eye, literally. Drawing on his expertise in human-computer interaction and mechanical engineering, Dexter leads the development of the next generation of patented nerve-sensing electroneurogram technology and integration for disruptive capabilities, fueling important work at Bose, Microsoft, Google, and Boeing. Dexter's work has been transformational in changing lives for the better for those struggling with neurodegenerative diseases, and he has been recognized by the ALS Association for his important work in this area. Dexter is also a subject matter expert in human factors for the Augmented Reality Enterprise Alliance, otherwise known as ARIA. This is such an exciting discussion for our Mentor Project students and teachers, especially those that are looking at accessibility, human performance, autonomy. Dexter, it's so great to have you on the show. Thanks for taking the time for us today.
Thank you, JJ. It's my pleasure to spend time with you. I'd love to talk about all these topics.
Yeah. So let's dive right in. I would love to know the background story and what inspired you to do the work that you're doing today.
Yeah, thank you for asking that. Yeah, the story started about 4.5 years ago, was when we were incorporated in 2016. But really, the inspiration for the problem that I saw, really, which is the way I think about it, is like, what's the problem that like I'm acutely trying to like alleviate the pain for in the world? It started when my mother was diagnosed with ALS, the condition that is neuromuscular in nature. And so what happened with my mother when she told me that she was diagnosed with that condition, then I didn't know what that would meant. And then ultimately I read up on it on the internet and saw that the symptoms would be that she would lose the ability to move her hands, the ability to move her feet, to eat or even breathe. And this was terrifying for her, for our family. And as it manifested within my mother's condition, she was most affected in her hands. She like first experienced a symptom when she was lifting up a bag on an airplane, and she just couldn't do it. And then she told me about it. And then overall, she within a matter of a handful of months, she couldn't lift a fork to feed herself anymore. Couldn't put on clothes, obviously. And the problems really sort of culminated in a super vivid manner for me was that, my mother used to love to read, and, she converted to ebooks. And then one day I asked her, when is the last time she read a book? And she said it was like 2 months ago. And my heart dropped, because that was something she used to do every day. And that's, what gave her joy. And so I saw that this pain point that was personal for me was also extensible to dozens and dozens of other people affected by ALS. And, I started thinking about the technology solution that could possibly, help this community. And that's what launched myself and to find my co-founder, David Cipolletta, to then create the technology that became Fundamental Technology.
Yeah. And I've had the privilege to see in action, and it's truly impressive. A lot of people would call it, Jedi technology, because literally you can just, blink an eye or twitch a finger or a muscle and move something or make something do something. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I know with many of these neurodegenerative disorders and diseases that you have to really, be able to capture those subtle movements in order to enable the person, the individual that's using your devices to be successful. How hard was that to do? And what were some of the challenges you had to overcome in that space?
Yeah. Thanks for clarifying and characterizing the problem set, which is one, it's the body is first of all has impulse is an intention all the time. We just aren't recognizing or using it. For example, when we are trying to move our fingers to, you know, lift up a pencil to write, ultimately there's a coordination between our brain to our entire body, and the neuromuscular system is working in concert with that. Well, that electrical field that's being generated is actually, you know, able to be sensed on the surface of the skin. We have developed sensors that are capturing it at the top of the wrist, like a watch. And therefore, we have a form factor where a person puts on the equivalent of what looks like the size of an Apple Watch. And then when a person is moving their finger up and down or their thumb up and down, we are capturing that voltage, intercepting it almost like a toll gate on a road, and cars have to drive through it. That traffic is just passing through us, and we're sensing it and then sending it to the phone to do machine learning and processing on it. And then at the end point, we're transferring those fully classified signals to an application like a smart home application or being able to control, for example, drones or augmented reality. And so the concept sounds simple, that a person can think about moving their finger to control something, but really there's many sequences in that workflow that relate to intercepting those body signals that are naturally occurring, making them intelligently and machine readable, and then being able to tie in a front-end application to use it. And this is what makes the technology very, very hard to build, but also extremely impactful and meaningful to a large number of people in the world.
Yeah, and I love the fact that you're able to leverage such a powerful technology to control so many different items. For example, I know you guys had a story out here recently talking about, you know, controlling robotics so that if you're doing a search and rescue scenario, the robot's actually carrying a lot of the load and is able to help with the search and rescue, and people can control, you know, robots, or in the case that they're trying to map a large area, they can control multiple drones. So one of the case studies that we had looked at is how could we deal with something like Fukushima better, where we're not risking people like humans having to send them in there. And, you know, is definitely a capability that would allow you to vector robots and drones into a space to figure out, are there people there, you know, measure the radioactivity of different areas and really get a better understanding of the picture. Can you talk a little bit about some of those applications? Because I think that's very exciting too, because you're talking about reducing risk and reducing exposures in important ways that I think are useful both here on Earth, but could also be useful in space operations or beyond.
Yeah, I appreciate that question. And ultimately, what is speaking to build? And we're seeing that there's this larger trend that technology is accelerating at an exponential manner, and that autonomy and AI are inevitable in every single aspect of our lives. And where does a human fit into this then? Given that we have more robots, more intelligence, more prediction and context about what humans may want or not want to do on a given basis. And so this concept of, you know, it's called human-machine teaming becomes very present. And so the human-machine teaming might be 80% human, 20% robot, or it might eventually be 10% human, 90% robot. But the human is always going to be the bottleneck in technology advancement for something like interacting with robots to proceed down an unsafe area that humans can't proceed down, like in Fukushima, for example. And so we see that we can help that transition between a, you know, how a robot is traditionally controlled through joysticks and remote control and teleoperated, to something where that robot is mostly autonomous, but then you're using our tech, which is being able to do gestures in the air, for example. Like every gesture you would do on your phone today, we can already provide that in a touchless manner. Touchless gesture control is what we call it. So for example, tapping on the screen, you would tap on the screen, but instead what we do is we say the user can lift up their index finger. Mm-hmm. And we're capturing that voltage on the top of the wrist. We're classifying it as a tap on the phone or holding or swiping left and right, up and down. And so therefore, you know, users can imagine having an invisible menu in front of them.
Right.
And then being able to poke at that menu or swipe in that menu as if it was physically there.
That's so
and
cool.
Then we map those signals to a system like a robotic system that has pre-programmed autonomy features, like going into the next building and then turning on these sensors that send back any alerts if they have radiation coming out of them that they are aware of. So we are basically the glue between the human and the electronic systems. And this glue, though, then creates completely disruptive functionality that would otherwise not be capable of occurring.
That's so cool. Just the idea that, you know, we can walk through this world and do something as simple as point and send a message, or, you know, tap something in the air, or give a thumbs up, or wave, and it causes, you know, potentially a multitude of devices to respond in a certain way is very exciting, and it's a very powerful idea. So what are some of the big challenges that you're working on today, and how do you think what you've developed is going to address or overcome those challenges?
Yeah, thank you. There's two major aspects to be addressing about, you know, the challenges we are facing. There's obviously technology challenges. We are building quite complicated hardware, software, cloud, machine learning technology, plus there's a human in the loop. And so there's human factors and variability. And then there's also another problem set, which is which product do we actually build for which market? Do we focus on particular consumer product? Are we focusing on integration to an existing smart home infrastructure like Google or Amazon? Or is there some sort of, you know, drone application that we want to offer for the government? And so there's equally and very significant complexity in being able to address the technology as well as the product market problem set. So on the technology side, there is, you know, we started with the hardware, and then ultimately, if you think about the human body, the electrical problem set that we started with ALS was that, you know, the nerves and muscular systems are electrically, you know, powered. And so, emanating electricity. So therefore, I saw the problem set as an electrical problem, and therefore we need to have an electrical solution. And so problem set one, micro task one, was how do we sense anything useful on the skin? And how do we both amplify it as well as clean it, as well as decipher something intelligent from it? So for example, what happened with our users of ALS, some of my friends who have ALS and other people, we started, you know, placing our electrodes on basically the entire body. And it might be their arms or the legs or their face or their neck. And we saw that the signals had different frequencies depending on where we placed them on the body. And then I started thinking about how do we standardize the placement of our technology, and therefore ultimately realize the only standardized place for a sensor is actually the top of the wrist. There's no other part of the body that would be standardized in a way where a user would know how to put it on the exact same way every day. And so that's what led us down to the form factor and the placement. And therefore the signals, though, are much harder to capture at a large enough amplitude. And so being able to clean up the signals is a very, very big problem set and challenge. And being able to find the frequencies that matter for us. What we saw was that traditional EMG would be focused on a frequency base between 50 to 400 hertz. We started seeing a lot of important machine learning features in the higher frequencies. Mm-hmm. And therefore, we could start pushing the state of the art. Not the fact that there's an ALS user, which is, of course, an important dimension, but also the placement is an important dimension. And then the signal processing then becomes a novel place to add invention. And so we started realizing we can file patents on the fact of all this combination, but especially the fact that we're discovering feature sets that were at different frequencies. And so for us, you know, for me, as a mechanical engineer, you know, I entered into this tech world thinking that most of the tech in the world was already invented. And then really, as I started building this company, I realized, wow, you know, maybe very minority of technology has been invented and people have the opportunity to invent it today. And so that was an eye-opening moment for me to realize that, you know, there is still so much work to be done in the world, and that it requires, number one, people willing to be able to challenge the status quo and push it much beyond where it is existing.
Yeah. And Dexter, I love your point about, you know, how you came up with the form factor, and then also how you were translating the signals almost to interpret them as their own programming language so that any user was able to control whatever devices they were connecting to, you know, to benefit them or to benefit their operations. You know, talk a little bit about that. When you and your team were looking at it and the fact that, you know, I've talked to a number of different entrepreneurs, and in every case, much like you, they see the potential that there's so much yet to be done. There's so much yet to be explored. Do you think that that has a lot to do with the diversity of perspective from your team and the different backgrounds that you brought together, and that helped them to also identify, and it helped you to also identify, you know, this as a potential problem when others missed it? Talk a little bit about that, because I'm touching base with a lot of different teams right now, and all of them are seeing opportunities that a lot of other people don't see. And it's really unique, and it's an interesting conversation. And they also tend to have diverse teams with a lot of different life experiences that they're bringing together. And because of those perspectives, they're able to solve problems in a way that is really unique and powerful.
That's a very good point, which is, you know, in what manner of experience or team makeup, you know, is a company or is an entrepreneur able to take a completely different lens of the world, right? And like, why is my lens shaped the, you know, way it is? It's because of my experience. And my background was, you know, from MIT in mechanical engineering and robotics. And then I worked in the finance industry for a number of years. And from there, I learned about optimization and about latencies. And so, and then obviously the problems that I learned about was firsthand from my mother. I experienced a control problem because she couldn't interact and control, you know, a computer to read books. And so I was, for better or worse, approached the situation, not from an academic viewpoint, but from a very, you know, practical standpoint, which is my mother had this problem. How do I solve it?
Right.
And obviously, like when we started the company, we ran up against quite a lot of disbelief. Yeah. That we knew what we were doing, that, you know, why hadn't we talked to hundreds of EMG specialists in the world? And I did talk to a bunch of accessibility technology experts. And I talked to a lot of commercial consumer electronics experts. And what I realized is that, you know, people generally and the experts generally are seeing things in terms of what's state of the art in their own literature or in their own technology circles. But for example, using EMG or a neuromuscular based input for control is not new in the world. It's been decades old, investigated as a subject matter. But to do so with the purpose of non-movement from a user base that has no ability to move their any part of their hands, like an ALS user, that was new. And therefore, the signals are completely different. And then the human factors and cognitive load challenges are completely different. And so I just had approached it from a particular subset, you know, magnified problem statement, as opposed to the academia world, which is just trying to push the art or the science for the sake of publishing papers,
right,
for example. And then that leads down to, you know, this concept that even our technology, like many technologies, might be an umbrella capability. Like it could be viewed as a platform, or it could be an unlocking basic science capability. Well, how do we actually make that impact? What's the product that we launch in the world that people actually buy? And who is that person? How much do they pay? What is the use case? How does it actually change their life on a daily basis, mm-hmm, in detail? That's ultimately a question that I wish I should have asked myself much earlier, which is, you know, what's that exact product? Because we could think about hypothetically that gesture control technologies can be used to control anything in the world, just like voice technologies could, just like a computer mouse could be used for any purpose for computing. But what are the first couple killer apps that are really important to focus on? And that's where the rubber meets the road. And we realized, well, what is unique about our capability? What can we add in a differentiated manner today as the first minimum viable and minimum lovable products in the world? And we realized it was actually for some users to be able to control mapping systems by pointing at things in the real world. Like if I asked you, where's Starbucks, you would probably say, yeah, it's around the corner. And you wouldn't pull out your phone to show me if it was nearby. You would probably point at it. And so we're realizing, how do we allow people to use their natural intention of communicating to other humans and just allowing technology to translate that into a digital manner and to be able to drop waypoints into maps and manipulate maps and other systems and save the user from being able to think about how 3D space in the real world has to become limited into 2D map systems. And so that ultimately, after a lot of searching and customer conversations, is what led us down to the specific thing that we plan to sell in the first year.
Yeah, that's an awesome story of how you got to where you are. And let me just touch on the one point, because I'm curious. This is also a trait I see in a lot of successful entrepreneurs. When you were bumping up against all those people that are like, why didn't you talk to these people? And they were very skeptical of what you were doing. I know your mom was a major driver in finding the solution and the success and making this work. But what else kept you going? Because I've encountered a lot of people that have also met with resistance because many can't see what they're imagining, or they can't see, you know, what they're seeing in the future as they're pulling all of these technologies together in a meaningful way to solve this problem. What kept you going? What was really, you know, the thing that told you, hey, I can do this and I believe in it and I've got an idea that I know is worthwhile?
That's a very challenging question. It's a deep one, because ultimately, if a company is creating something new in the world, it's new and it doesn't exist. And so therefore, there's going to be at least a majority of the world who is not going to be in agreement of that technology and that company. Just otherwise, it would have existed already. So anybody creating anything new should realize that the majority of people they come across will not understand, nor appreciate, nor value what they're building. So if you get used to that, then how deep can you go into that level of disagreement and controversy? You realize, well, you can't be the only person who thinks this right. Otherwise, you'll never be able to raise any funding. You won't be able to convince engineers to join your team. You won't be able to like sell your vision. So you need something in between 0 to 50% of people in the world who buy into this. Otherwise, again, it would be something that exists in the world already. So for example, I recognize, okay, well, the medical experts and the academic experts don't understand or see what we're doing. And after we've built, you know, prototypes and then shown them, you know, actual users, then they have an aha moment. But, you know, they were thinking about it the way they were thinking about it. So I think the challenge for an entrepreneur is realizing, to what extent are they wedded to an exact vision that they have? Mm-hmm. And then to what extent are they willing to be flexible with the realities of trying to raise money as well as bring people on the team to reconcile back to reality a bit. I think given our technology, I didn't know when we were starting that our technology was ridiculously radical in so many ways. It just seemed normal to me that, you know, new technologies for people with ALS would exist. No, they don't. And so I didn't know I was like much on the far end of the spectrum of being crazy. And you know, if you build a crazy company, then you're going to create crazy value ultimately. Yeah. And that's the way I think about it. But ultimately, you know, I think about companies that build very simple things and they make ridiculous value too, like a company like Slack or a company like Zoom. Obviously, those technologies existed for, you know, maybe over a decade. And yet they said there's a better way to do it. And it's a very simple product. It's very straightforward. And, you know, just nobody had taken the focus to, again, put on the lens of user-centric design. The same thing for Dropbox. It's that technology existed. It just wasn't user-centered design. And so what's a larger trend in the world is that most base technologies exist. However, the value creation is actually in making it usable and adopted by people on a daily basis. And therefore, being able to close that gap with a technology that adds value and actually, you know, bring it down to, you know, a layman's version that anybody can pick up and use, that's actually a lot of value creation there. And maybe the majority of value creation for an entrepreneur is thinking about just easing the friction of technologies that exist and bringing it to market. And so I think a lot about that and how to de-risk technology, given that we already have an adoption curve that we have to surpass and try to create relatable technologies. So one important decision we made when we plan to launch our first product, which is later this year for phone control, is, well, do we want to focus on phones, which there are, you know, 6 billion phones in the world?
Right.
Or do we want to focus on drones, which there are only some hundreds of thousands of drones? Or do we want to focus on augmented reality, which there are, you know, only handfuls of them used on a daily basis? And so this friction of reaching end users becomes, you know, what's called a dependency to scale. And I didn't want another technology to be a dependency. So that's why we chose phones, because there are already 6 billion of them in the world. And therefore, we don't have to worry about that integration point not reaching maturity yet.
That's cool. All right. I love that. And it's very exciting to see where you're going next. I would ask, as you're moving forward, I know you've done a lot of work for the ALS community and also helped some of the other communities out that are dealing with similar diseases. What's your hope going forward in the future to help these communities and to really give back to the people that are struggling with many of these diseases? What would you like to see if you were able to do anything with this technology? What would bring you the most joy?
So first of all, I think this concept of giving back, I have struggled with that concept because in general, because when I was at MIT as a student, then, you know, there were a lot of bright people I was surrounded by, and many of them were debating between, you know, going to work at a consulting company or a banking company, which were at the times the cool jobs, right, that were going to fulfill them financially. And then they would figure out how to give back in some sort of meaningful manner later on. I realized that the people who made those decisions were really not making a decision at all, or they had made a decision, which was that it wasn't a priority for them. And so that's fine that people do so. But I think, I mean, we only live life once, right? And so every second of our day is gone forever. And so to be able to like live life intentionally, to realize, okay, if every second of my day is gone, that just passed, it's forever, you know, like wasted. Well, we need to make sure we're going pretty directly towards what we want to achieve in our life. And maybe for young people, they don't know what they want to achieve, and that's totally fine. Then the advice would be just learn as much as possible, and you'll figure that out. But you know, optimize for learning, and you know, pushing yourselves in those boundaries. And that's what like ultimately I did was I pushed myself to an industry I didn't know anything about. I pushed myself to a finance industry where the job was incredibly challenging, and then I still didn't know where it would lead me. But I think it was something that I thought about. I was like, well, where's my aspect of help, you know, participating in, you know, advancing technology or society, which it was not doing in that job. And I realized that the skills I was building, though, were important for me, that are important for me now in leading the company. And I think that, you know, there should be, you know, people shouldn't really think too hard about giving back. It's either if they care about it, then just try to align their actions. We obviously were founded and originated with the purpose of helping people with ALS. Right now, we're working on multiple contracts for the National Science Foundation with the ALS Association to be able to use our technology, which is both sensing, data, software, and analysis, to be able to provide in a completely new way of quantifying ALS progression over time, because currently that state of the art is incredibly crude. For, you know, the most debilitating condition there is in the world, there's almost no great way to measure it. And if you can't measure that technology, which is currently being done by a questionnaire that a person asks, and those questions are, for example, can you feed yourself? On a scale of 1 to 4, can you feed yourself? And you start thinking about, well, is that actually a great way to measure neuromuscular conditions? And then are you going to measure the the therapeutic benefit of a new drug just by asking a person 12 questions. And that is honestly how the world works. And so we realized this digital health application of neuromuscular progression tracking or atrophy quantification is going to be highly impactful for everything in the world with neuromuscular based for disease tracking, as well as recovery, as mm-hmm. well as therapeutics. And so we see this longer vision that we would be the company that would know the most about how the human body nerve system works in the peripheral side, peripheral nervous system side. Mm-hmm. And we're continually working with our partners to get there. It's obviously strategically important to our company. It's going to take many years to get something that goes and is effective on a clinical trial basis for many, many years, many thousands of users.
Right.
But we see a pathway where every single clinical trial for ALS, for Parkinson's, for MS, for other conditions would be able to utilize our sensing system and analysis to be able to afford them more insights related to how the human body is changing. That is what would give me a great amount of joy for us to accomplish long term. It will take many years to get there.
Yeah, but I love that you've got that as a goal. And I've already seen just from watching some of the videos and reading some of the articles about your work, the impact that it's having on, you know, giving people the ability to live fully every moment of their life. And so that's really powerful. You know, a lot of our students, as they're looking forward to areas that interest them, they always ask, hey, ask the people that you're talking to on the podcast, what would be the best advice? You know, what should I focus on? Where should I, you know, try to learn the most? Do you have any recommendations, or are there any areas that you feel if somebody wanted to go into this area or to learn more, how would they go about doing that opportunity wise or experientially? What would you recommend?
That's a wonderful question. I think tangibly, everybody has this desire and this ambition to ensure that their lives are being purposeful.
Right.
And I know I definitely had that when I was younger and I was lacking direction. And, you know, all I knew was get good grades and go to college and get a job. And I think, you know, there might be a lot of ambitious people all over the world now who have the opportunity to learn off the internet anything they want. And that's actually pretty intimidating and overwhelming, because you do have this sense that, like, well, you know, how do I ensure by the end of my life I've actually, you know, utilized all these resources effectively mm-hmm. to make the most difference? And ultimately, you know, I guess I think about it like it's not a big deal. You know, just try to learn, follow your passions, because I did not intend to create a company, you know, when I was younger. I didn't necessarily think it was in my trajectory of my life. I wasn't planning to do it when we created the company in 2016. Nor before. I was simply just trying to live my life to the best way I thought. And then a problem set fell on my lap with my mother's condition. Mm-hmm. It was clear to me that I needed to care, but I didn't know that it would ultimately lead me to create a company. And I think the attitude should be just learn as much as possible. And because when you learn as much as possible, you will be exposed to problems that you weren't aware of. And then there will magically be a time when you're sparked to dig in a bit more. So for myself, you know, obviously taking care of my mother on a daily basis was, you know, emotionally, physically, and spiritually something that, you know, I had to think about a lot and was not easy. And then what happened was I found myself thinking late into the night and then waking up only a few hours later, thinking again further about that technology access problem for human machine interfaces. And that was honestly, as weird as it is, during my mom's time of ALS and me caretaking for her, that's like what got me fascinated and super excited about. And then when she passed away, you know, she had ALS for only 1 year.
Right.
Then there was a point in my time when I'm thinking, well, what do I do with my life now? And I guess I was really odd, because I was thinking, well, this is something that's still on my mind, this human machine interface challenge and how humans and AI are going to be merging in an irreversible manner over the years.
Right.
If this is not a passion, what is?
Right.
And I think I'd always been skeptical of, like, well, when do you take the leap? Well, I don't know when you take the leap, But for me, it's like, I would have been dumb to say that that wasn't a passion because I was telling every single person about how much I care about the problem set. And it was like, it took, you know, and once I realized, I was like, okay, better lean into this. But I mean, I didn't, that problem, you know, just kind of arrived in my lap and I happened to care and I happened to give the attention to it. I would just say for anybody, you know, if they really have the motivation to try to be ambitious with something and make some level of impact with their lives or upon other people, just expose yourself to more problems because ultimately something will stick.
Yeah. And that's great advice because, you know, the folks that I've talked to and my own personal experiences, all of those problem sets that we bump up against, they're learning opportunities and they kind of sharpen us and point us down the path towards where we're heading next. And it's very exciting to hear you say that because based on your experiences and where you've taken the company and heading as far as touching so many lives in so many amazing ways, it seems like, you know, the negatives actually turned into positives for you.
I think I don't know how to predict what's always going to happen in my life. And it's really hard to do so for anybody. And I mean, it's like, I remember when I was in high school, I was thinking about, well, which college am I going to go to? And I had no idea. Right. And then I applied to MIT because my brother applied there. Right. So it just happened to be that my brother went to MIT and therefore that. So you just never know the coincidences that lead you to, you know, for certain circumstances. Obviously, I was super fortunate about that. Yeah. And then even, you know, trying to choose a job coming out of college, I just realized, okay, I'm bright. I have skills. I'm an engineer. You know, I don't have to be worried about not having a job for the rest of my life. Let me just try to like learn.
Right.
And I think that's, you know, but I didn't feel comfortable with that because, you know, there were social pressures about this. And ultimately, like I mentioned, anybody who's trying to make something new mm-hmm. is going to be rubbing up against the existing status quo, which is at least 50% of the population.
Right.
So you should just realize if people say what you're doing is dumb or a bad idea, or they don't agree or understand, that's actually normal. And it's not a sign at all that you should stop. And I think I didn't have the confidence and self-security to be able to like pick up on that fast enough in the world. I probably in hindsight would have probably gone to business school earlier than I did mm-hmm. in 2016. I was already 32 years old. And then I also would have, would have done it earlier. I would have also not listened to other people as much. Mm-hmm. But honestly, you know, it's okay. Everybody figures it out. And honestly, we got long lives to live. So it's not a big deal if we are slow to the curve on any of this. So just becoming super comfortable in your own skin is really a major part of life.
Yeah. And Dexter, I hate to end the conversation. So let me ask you our last question, because this has been fantastic. If you're talking to one of our aspiring innovators, one of our youth entrepreneurs, what is one piece of advice that you would give them, you know, based on your experience and the journey that you've taken thus far?
No matter what, just, you know, the optimal goal in terms of skill sets that need to be exercised to accomplish something. I remember I was talking to some admissions directors at MIT, you know, even after I graduated, and they told me like they look back at all the skill sets that make somebody successful. And then, you know, there's good grades, there's high, you know, test scores, there's, you know, all these. Ultimately, they realized the most important trait was resourcefulness.
Oh.
And so being able to like you know, life is full of problems. To what extent can you like solve those problems in creative ways, gather resources that you don't have yourself to solve problems? Everybody can solve problems if they have all the tools given to them. That's easy, but the larger world and creating something new means gathering resources that you don't have, or you don't even know you need or are aware of, and then begging and borrowing and you know, grabbing them as aggressively as possible and synthesizing them in your head. So resourcefulness is really important. And you only learn that by putting yourself in uncomfortable positions.
Oh, that's so true. And that's a great place for us to end today. Dexter, I so much appreciate your time and all of the wonderful work you're doing. Thanks for joining the show today. And for our guests and our audience, Please tune in next week when we'll have a new wonderful guest and a new wonderful audience and lots more positive tech stories to share. Dexter, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, JJ.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Impactful Innovations Podcast with JJ Snow. If you learned something new and this podcast made you think, then share ITSPmagazine.com with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you represent a company and wish to associate your brand with our conversations, sponsor one or more of our podcast channels. We hope you will come back for more stories and follow us on our journey. You can always find us at the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society.